I was following the packs, all swallowed in their coats.
That's, I'm sure this is doubly confusing. You're hearing like a Fleet Foxes song, and you're also hearing this like ethereal kind of intro tune situation. Sorry about that. Hi. Yeah. Time to wrap up this pre-intro. You are listening to Zabuma Foolish with me. Hey, girl. It's your host, Jay. Full name, Jaylen. Don't know why I am like this. Let's jump into the episode, y'all. Hey, you came, you made it, you arrived. Another episode is here in your ears. That's right. We have arrived at this week's episode of Zabuma Foolish, and it is episode 11. Stop what you're doing right now, and if you're hearing this number, go and search 11 angel numbers in Google and see what comes up. See if it's an important message for you. Now, back to the matter at hand. This week's episode, and more specifically, this week's animal of the week, is courtesy of Jamila. Yeah, Jamila. No, not Jamila Jamil. That is a problematic individual who should not have been a guest judge on... Wow, do you ever have something that just flies out of your brain? Jamila Jamil was a guest judge on the show Legendary. Yes, on the show Legendary, which is an amazing show. If you haven't watched it, please go watch it. It's about the history and the legacy and the culture of voguing and ballroom. And it is just, oof, it gives you that sensation, honey. And Jamila Jamil should not have been a judge. Maybe a guest judge. Anyway, very roundabout way of me trying to shout out Jamila, who is on Instagram as the Soulful Veganista. And she also partially runs the Instagram account Afro Vegan Society. So if you're Black and vegan, you definitely should know who she is. And if you're not Black or vegan, you should still know who Jamila is. So hop on over to the IG, take a little pause on this podcast episode, give my homegirl a follow, a little bit of like, a little bit of love, because she is to thank for this week's animal of the week, which is, that's very right, octopuses. Yes, octopuses. Now, many of y'all hearing this word, octopuses, you're going to get, the first thing that's going to jump into your mind is going to be about the plurals, right? About the grammar, the pronunciation, the enunciation, the logistics, the linguistics behind this word. And I'm going to hit y'all with some facts today, okay? Because the OG plural of octopus is octopuses, right? Now, this is the gag, because around, I think what it was, the 1500s? Could have been different, but the general like group of people at the time that were alive, which I guess were just people, they were all like, oh my gosh, we got to make English like a little bit more like proper sounding. It's just like all over the place. So they were trying to like add some consistency all up into English. And so at that point in time, I think it was like 1581, could be wrong on the date, don't clock me for it, but octopuses was changed to have a Latin ending, octopi. Then the gag was a couple hundred years passed, and then they were like, oh my gosh, sis, that's not a Latin word, it's Greek. So then they were like, okay, we need to pop that shit back to octopodes. And then they were like, okay, bitch, this is just too messy. Like, English is English. Let's just make it octopuses. So here we are, 2021, with the official and correct plural for the word octopus being octopuses. Now that that conundrum is solved and out of the way, let's get straight into the gig. And I kind of just want to talk about octopuses more generally because they are an extremely diverse group of species. Like, y'all, there's like something like 300 plus species of octopus. Yeah, I know. I'm like, that's a gag. And the smallest is only like 1.5 centimeters, I think. The name is like, I really should have jot down this name. It was like the Star Sucker Pygmy Octopus. I think that's what it's called. And then the largest species of octopus is giant Pacific octopuses. And their like tentacles can reach like from tentacle to tentacle about 4.5 meters or about 14 feet. Okay. For reference, I'm about 6 feet. For your own reference, you probably know about how tall you are. Okay. So that's like twice me and then change. That's a gag. Imagine swimming. Like, and y'all would have clocked this in an earlier episode, but you know how I feel about oceans. Not the biggest fan. I like what's in them. Sure, not like going in them, okay? For several reasons. The salt as the main one. But octopuses, Pacific octopuses, are also another reason. I'm like, your suckers are strong. You have a beak. And I don't particularly want to just, like, come up on y'all. And no. Cause some drama, cause some aggravation, situation. No. You can have it. The ocean, that's yours. I'm gonna stay on land or in a lake. Now, if you haven't already seen it, I don't know, I'm not gonna be able to show it to you through this episode. So apologies for that. You'll have to head over to the Patreon. But I'm gonna share actually a video that someone recently sent to me of a Pacific octopus that was, it like trapped an eagle. Yeah, so this like bald eagle, I guess, was like swooping down into the water, or maybe it was tired and like just taking a break. And this octopus was like, birds of a feather, nah, you ain't sticking together because I'm a clock this meal, this happy meal done plopped its way into my arena and I'm a sucker it up into my little beak situation. So that video was wild to me. I personally had never, ever heard of an octopus eating an eagle. And the fact that someone was able to capture this on video, gag. So that'll be over on the Patreon. But something that we kind of need to discuss now more specifically, right, is the what makes octopuses so great, you know? So I actually have a tattoo. I have an octopus tattoo on my right leg. Excuse me, a little burp action there. So I have an octopus tattoo on my right leg, and it's actually my first tattoo. And when people like ask me, they're always like, oh, what does this mean? It's straight up just a reminder of the complexity, ingenuity, creativity, and brilliance that is octopuses. And me personally, at the time when I got it, I think I was like a teen and I had just like ran away from home and whatever. And I was like, no one understands me. I'm just an octopus living in a world with cows. Not to say that people were cows, but I like cows generally. And so I was like, okay, everyone's like cows. And then I was just felt like an octopus. This is a very roundabout way to introduce me talking about the physiology and the behavioral traits of octopuses. And yeah, so one of the things I kind of want to mention that threw me through a loop when I first discovered it was the fact that octopuses have beaks. Yeah, I know. For like, oh my gosh, I just clocked that they could have had like a beak fight in the water between the eagle and the octopus, the Pacific octopus. Yeah, but for me, I was shocked because it's actually one of the only solid parts of the octopus's body. Yeah, that's right. So they're essentially just like all muscle, which makes them like super squishy, ishy situation. And they also don't have any air pockets in their body. So unlike us humans, like we have so many different cavities, like in between our organs, inside of our organs, all of this other stuff where there's just like air. There's just like lots of air. For example, in our intestines, that's probably one of the most common places for air to collect and then be expelled via a fart. And so I'm shocked. Yeah, that octopuses, they don't have any air inside of their body. And this allows them to compress their super muscular figure form into really, really small shapes. So essentially, if they can get their beak through it, they can fit through it. That's like the general rule for octopuses. And that's only about the size, like the beak's circumference is about like, I don't know, a quarter, a loony, depending on the species, could be smaller, could be a little bit bigger. And so you're telling me you're able to get your entire body compressed down through this little sliver of a hole? Ooh, if you don't go off, go all the way off. Now, something that's super exciting for me and hopefully for y'all as well is I found a way to connect this week's Animal of the Week with our next segment, Experiment 626, and that's looking at it through the lens of intelligence. Yes, that's right, animal intelligence. And I don't want to give y'all any spoilers for the next segment, so let's just head into Experiment 626. Now, for this week's Experiment 626, I wanted to focus on a paper that talks about the evolution of intelligence. And it does so through talking about how intelligence evolved in octopuses and cephalopods, more generally. Now, if you are not studying animal behavior and cognition like me, no worries. That's actually what I'm here for. And I'm just here to give you all that good, good info. And so you don't have to spend thousands of dollars and commit all this time to learning about it. Bam! Just give you with the little tidbits, the little Pop-Tart pieces. And so the first thing I kind of want to talk about with this paper, first off, the paper is called Grow Smart and Die Young. Why Did Cephalopods Evolve Intelligence? And I want to talk about the title of this paper just a little bit now, because I think it alludes to something that's it's a very hard question to answer, right? Where it's this phenomenon that happens with a lot of particularly intelligent animals as well, but just with species more generally, is that the lifespan of some of our most intelligent animals is so short that the ability for them to evolve intelligence, it doesn't really make sense, because intelligence and cognition is expensive, right, to develop. There is a trade-off in developing your brain capacity, your ability to think and hold space and memory. It's like it actually has tangible trade-offs for the individual, right? And so we have a lot of situations where we have like relatively young animals who are fairly smart, and it's a gag because it doesn't make sense in terms of the evolutionary trajectory. And I think that this is kind of what this paper wants to get at and to discuss, right? And so the first thing that this paper talks about, or one of the first things that this paper talks about, which I'm going to kind of make clear, is that there are two generally agreed upon hypotheses for the evolution of intelligence in animals. Now, remember, when we talk about scientific hypotheses, we're not talking about it as in like, oh my gosh, this is like a maybe if and or situation, but it's like the overwhelming abundance of data and information and knowledge available about this thing suggests this, right? That's usually how that works. In terms of, oh, wow, I really can't speak today. So yeah, in terms of like a hypothesis, it's like the total amount of available data about this all points towards one thing. And that's why we have a general hypothesis or theory for gravity, right? And so, yeah, the main hypothesis for the evolution of intelligence, y'all, is this sort of ecological intelligence hypothesis, right? So this hypothesis suggests that complex cognition, the ability to like think outside of the box, develop really smart strategies, all of these sort of cognitive abilities, right, evolved in order for the individual to meet the challenges associated with finding and processing food. That's it. So essentially what this theory is stating, that due to the complexity and the variation that exists within nature already, right? For individuals to take advantage, to access specific food, to find specific food, right? In order to store it or process it, like, internally, what have you, right? When it comes to just the acquisition and the consumption of different foods, right? Is that it requires complex cognitive processes, right? It requires you to have really developed spatial memory. It requires you to be able to discern between potential harmful foods and things that could be potentially beneficial for you. It requires you to have really good episodic memory. It also requires you to have really good, like, recall. So there's memory just generally, right, is comprised of three parts, right? The first being storage, so like where we store it in the brain. The second being encoding, so how we like attach that memory now to a specific feeling or a specific experience or a specific instance, right? In order for us to then, three, recall that memory. So memory in general, right, is a really important cognitive function and it has a lot of different sort of facets to it. But going back to this main theory, right, this ecological intelligence hypothesis, right, it's not just memory, but the collective cognitive functions that require individuals to succeed in specific environments, right? And that success is centered around being able to successfully access and process different foods. Now, What do you mean, Jalen? What do you mean when you say the ability to process and find food? Well, okay, if I'm going to be more specifically, if we're going to speak more specifically about this, right, I'm talking about things like spatially and temporally diverse food. So food that is not available across your habitat, it's only available in specific spaces, right? Food that is only available at specific times of the years, right? So this is what we mean by spatial temporally dispersed food sources. That requires a lot of cognitive mechanisms for you to be able to successfully access those different food sources over time, right? Throughout your habitat area. And this is why a lot of generalist diets, for example, also coincide with individuals who are really intelligent or have a lot of cognitive capacity for growth. And that just simply means, or what that's suggesting is, like, the more food or the more types of food you eat, the more you're going to need to use your brain in order to understand which foods are safe, which are dangerous, how you're even going to eat specific foods, how you're going to, like, the ability to crack a crab shell and eat it is going to be very different from the ability to find a ripe banana and consume it, right? And so looking at how you store and access memories, and then specifically tie those memories to other cognitive traits that will allow you to not only recognize food sources, but access them, is the main sort of component of this ecological intelligence hypothesis. Now, the second theory, right, the second hypothesis for how intelligence developed or how intelligence evolved over time is the social intelligence hypothesis theory. Now, this is actually my favorite theory. It's what I'm doing the majority of my master's work about, and I'm gonna save that for a different episode. But the social intelligence hypothesis theory essentially suggests that the evolution of intelligence is a byproduct of the demands of living in really large social groups, right? So it's essentially saying that it's only in animals that have these really complex and social living arrangements, right? So it's maintaining these complex social bonds across time, across different age groups, right? The ability to deceive members of your own species group, the ability to cooperate with members of your own species group, right? All of these different aspects, right, of living in highly socialized environments or groupings, right, is what could have developed this intelligence or evolved this intelligence over time, right? And this theory essentially suggests that the more social, the larger the group of animals are, the larger, that doesn't make sense, the more intelligent or the more cognitive mechanisms in play that species sort of has or can represent. And the social intelligence hypothesis theory, I should make note here, it was developed in relation to primates, right? And so primates serve as the benchmark or almost litmus test for intelligence in other social animals. And we compare, right, the social arrangements of other species with primates when we're trying to understand how intelligence could have evolved through this social intelligence framework, right? A really clear example, I think, that makes this a little bit more digestible, if you're just hearing this for the first time, is how we have practiced or how we've studied the social intelligence hypothesis theory with hyenas. So a group of researchers, I'm going to do a really quick overview because this has nothing to do with the paper at all, but essentially a group of researchers went out and they were like, look, hyenas live in very complex, very large social groups similar to baboons. This would then suggest that the intelligence of baboons is comparable to the intelligence evolved in hyenas. They did some comparative tests. It's not easy to compare apples and oranges or hyenas and baboons. But long story short is that the social framework of hyenas, the way that hyenas socialize and integrate and hunt and cooperate and deceive and mate, all of these different factors of the hyena's social life, they matched up. And so they were able to be like, okay, gag, we can apply this kind of social intelligence hypothesis theory to other vertebrates, to other examples of vertebrate intelligence. Right. Now, let's wind it back. Let's step up in to this week's paper, talking about it more specifically through the lens of cephalopods and octopodes. Because the gag is that under the theory, the social intelligence hypothesis theory, right, octopuses shouldn't be as smart as they are. They live relatively short, like a 2-3 years, we're talking, is their lifespan, okay? They are not social, right? So they don't really have that, like, group setting to really learn and grow and develop that intelligence quickly. But you do see, right, that there could be some merit in looking at the evolution of intelligence through this ecological theory or this ecological kind of hypothesis, because a lot of octopuses are generalist species. So, I mean, hearkening back to earlier in the episode, generalists are just those that can eat a wide variety of foods. And we have to remember too, right, that it's not just the fact that octopuses are generalists, but it's the ways in which they actually go about accessing this, the varieties of food, right? And so the main, I guess we could say, style for octopuses to search for and extract food is it's extractive in nature, right? It actually requires a lot of, I guess you could say, like, typically, like, energetically costly behavior, because it requires exploration, it requires multiple attempts often, right? And so in this exploration, in multiple attempts, right, this is how we categorize this as cognitive complexity through innovation, right, or behavioral flexibility, right? And so this is developed in octopuses because of their need to access, hunt, and forage for a variety of different food sources that are all available at different times of the day, at different seasons, or at different locations, right, within their three-dimensional aquatic habitat. But I think we've talked enough now about the sort of social intelligence hypothesis side of things, the ecological intelligence kind of side of things, ecological complexity side of things, I should say, right? And I want to talk now about a third hypothesis that this paper suggests or just talks about, right? And this third hypothesis suggests that intelligence, right, cognitive abilities and strategies actually evolved in response to challenges exerted by predators, right? So essentially, if you're a prey species or if something can eat you, right, you will have to develop strategies to trick, to cooperate, to collaborate, right? Different strategies in order to survive and avoid predation. So in the case of octopuses, right, we have they lack a protective shell. And so they're actually extremely vulnerable, right, especially in aquatic situations, to a wide range of predators. It can be cetaceans, it could be seabirds, it could be fishes, it could be other cephalopods, right? And so it's the diversity, right, of predators that are acting upon you, that are forcing you to find different ways to survive, that suggests, right, that maybe cephalopod evolution or the intelligence of evolution in cephalopods has maybe been more influenced by these like high predation pressures that only exist within their sort of marine environment. And the most iconic example of this that kind of gives validity to this theory of intelligence in octopuses and cephalopods specifically, right, through the predation sort of route, is their incredible camouflage abilities, right? Cephalopods generally, but octopuses more specifically, have such sophisticated mechanisms for camouflaging themselves, be it physically or behaviorally, right? They can facilitate this like rapid and extremely effective form of concealment visually from predators, despite themselves being colorblind. Isn't that a gag? Like, y'all, octopuses, octopi, octopodes, all of the cephalopod community, okay? They have what is called polar vision. And polar vision is really hard to explain for people like us who see in the visible light spectrum, but polar vision is essentially kind of like seeing in energies and also kind of like seeing in black and white. That's kind of how I want to describe it for y'all. And so tell me how, right? Tell me how the colorblind individual with no shell is out here being like, now I look like a crab, a blue crab with 14 pincers, like their ability to straight up completely shift the physical makeup of their bodies and match it so seamlessly with their physical environment just speaks to the level of awareness that octopuses have. It speaks to their ability to not only recognize themselves in this like 3D space that they occupy, but they can recognize themselves in relation to other objects and other animals sharing this space, right? So it's this almost like environmental awareness that they have. Absolutely mind-blowing. And remember earlier when I was talking about the fact that they don't have any like air pockets in their bodies, right? And so this actually allows them to use their extremely muscular physiology to actually shift and change the texture of their skin to also match the physical environment. So a completely smooth octopus can now go almost in an instant, almost instantaneously, right? Be covered in rough edges or sharp spikes or jutted out little points, right? And it's, for me, the gag is, for me, is that this is literally, it's almost instant. Like most octopuses are capable of doing these camouflage feats of ingenuity within seconds, right? And so that really, it really kind of validates this idea that maybe it was predation pressures that actually drove this form of intelligence in octopuses that we see today. And I think, honestly, y'all, like I can't we can't get too thick with the science every week, so I think I'm going to wrap up Experiment 626 here. But I did want to read this sort of end piece of the paper here, and it reads as the following. Thus, the investigation of cephalopods has the potential to unravel new insights into the evolution of intelligence, as well as inspiring new angles in the study of large brain vertebrates. Y'all, they really said octopuses fucked us all up collectively as a scientific community, and they might just shake the entire game for how we understand things. And you know what I love about science is that they are willing and ready for that change, y'all. As soon as that discovery is made, you best believe everyone and their publishers are going to be like, ooh, 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 new chapter here. Ooh, actually, knowledge is done. Update here. And that's, yeah, I just absolutely love science for that reason. And I thought that it was really nice for this paper to kind of end on this very inspiring and kind of like hopeful note. And the fact that it's literally all hinging on more exploration and investigation into cephalopods, like, gag me with a tentacle, because oof, I just love that. I love that messaging. Now let's move swiftly into this week's What's the Sitch? So what's the sitch? Oh, we have a doozy for this week's What's the Sitch. Staying on theme, we're going to be talking about it through the lens of octopuses first, and then I'm going to branch it out. I'm going to expand that so we can have a little bit more of a broader conversation around it. And for this week's What's the Sitch? I'm talking about animals escaping. That's right. What happens when wild animals escape their enclosures? A conflict that we don't often consider because the cases of it happening are usually kept under hush-hush. Like, I remember when I first moved here to Vancouver, and then there was this story of, like, a leopard or like a jaguar that escaped. And you would think that this would be like the biggest thing, but they were like, no, we're really trying to keep it like hush hush. Like in the article, they were even trying to be like, no, we don't want people to like freak out. And we have people in the area searching for it and blah, 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 blah. I'm like, ah, but that's not what we're talking about right now. Specifically, remember y'all, because this week's theme is octopuses. We're going to be talking about Inky. Yes, Inky the octopus. Now, if you've never heard of Inky the octopus, well, let's zoom out a bit and just clock that this name is brilliant, because octopuses produce ink as an escape strategy. Again, hearkening back to that sort of predatory pressure to develop these different strategies and these forms of intelligence. Bam. So anyway, ink is an exception, is an example, by the way, of a deception strategy, which is a cognitive ability. We won't get into that. We already passed. We already moved on from Experiment 66. We're talking about Inky now. And Inky is an example of life imitating art, imitating life imitating art, right? Because Finding Nemo imitated life when they created Finding Nemo, right? And subsequent sequel Finding Dory, which was, you know, as far as sequels go, Pixar really knows how to freaking put one together, like come through. And so, yeah, art imitates life, right? Imitates art because Inky watched Finding Dory and got inspired. Yeah. So if you will remember from Finding Dory, there was a scene with this octopus that escapes its enclosure to get back to the sea. And y'all, I'm not making this up. This is exactly what Inky did. Inky the octopus literally escaped their enclosure that was left slightly ajar and then headed down a pipe that leads to the ocean. If y'all aliens don't come collect your lost soul of a freaking intelligent brother, I cannot. I cannot with octopus. How are you out here captured all up in your enclosure, and you the second an opportunity for escape comes, you're like, yeah, not only do I know how to utilize and take advantage of this opportunity, but I know exactly what to do, exactly where to go. Bam, this is the pipe I need to escape to the ocean. So I'm actually gonna go and read the article for y'all about this, because it was too much. I was like doing research for the story and I was like, this can't be serious, but it is, yeah. So Inky, the octopus, made this brazen escape from the National Aquarium in New Zealand. And I was actually wrong. So I think I said earlier that the tank was left ajar, but apparently homegirl actually broke out of the tank and then slithered down a 50-meter drain pipe before disappearing into the sea. Now, there isn't actually CCTV footage of the event happening, but the staff who worked at the aquarium, when interviewed, they kind of all came to this understanding that Inky must have clambered to the top of his glass enclosure and then down the side of the tank before traveling across the floor of the aquarium. And y'all, if this isn't not the most wholesome thing ever, so Rob Jarl, who is actually the national manager of the National Aquarium of New Zealand, when he was interviewed, he gave this quote. He goes, "But Inky really tested the waters here. I don't think he was unhappy with us or lonely as an octopus. Because octopuses are solitary creatures, but he is such a curious boy. He would want to know what's happening on the outside. That's just his personality." Sorry. I'm so sorry if you are listening from Australia. That was my best Australian accent. But yeah, I just thought that was so goddamn wholesome. Because, I mean, Rob Jarl is right. Like, octopuses wouldn't necessarily suffer from that kind of, like, isolation or lonely situation or narrative that a lot of captive animals do suffer from. But I don't know. I do think that, you know, so little has been done with regards to cephalopod research and socialization that, you know, maybe there is an aspect of social octopus life that we just don't know yet. But back to Inky, right? So Inky slid across the aquarium floor, right? Allegedly. I love that when people have to just like scream allegedly when they're clearly talking about truth, but they have to scream because they don't have all the facts and they're like, oh my God, I'm gonna get sued. Anyway, so allegedly, Inky Dunn slid across the floor, which the staff measured to be a distance of about 3 to 4 meters, and then clocked the 50-meter long drain pipe, right? And then entered it and was like, yeah, here I come. The drain pipe actually opened out into Hawke's Bay, which is along the east coast of New Zealand's North Island. I just love that Inky did this. And I love that this was all recorded. And that they actually, like, the staff went all out. They have photos of Inky's enclosure. They have, like, measurements. They have the drain in question. So I'm gonna go ahead and, like, share all of those resources over on the Patreon, so you can kind of see like what it is we're talking about, how far Inky traveled, how big Inky was, all of that good, so you can like really paint the mental picture for ya. But I kind of want to take a second here and now like branch, open it up, talk about it, kind of leave you with this food for thought in that what happens when wildlife escape their enclosures, right, is always a problem. I mean, in the case of Inky, it was like not so much a problem because the staff, I guess, didn't really care. They were like, yeah, what have you. Also, Inky is like relatively small, so it isn't going to be going around doing a lot of harm. But what happens when this is like a grizzly bear or a polar bear or a gorilla or a panther or a cheetah, right? The larger the animal, the further in distance it is away from its typical traditional habitat, right? The greater the chances it is that that animal will have an extremely negative impact once it is escaped, right? And so I think this is a very unique form of conflict because it is both an example of human-wildlife conflict, like the potential of conflict between animals and people, but it's also an example of conflict between animals as well, or to non-human animals, I should specify, because of that risk and that potential for exotic species to then escape into the land and cause irreparable harm and damage to the populations of individuals who are already living there. And I want to just tie this quickly to sort of my own life to wrap it up before I leave y'all this week, which is in Ontario, so the home province where I'm from, there are no, when I say zero, I mean zero bylaws or laws in place that specifically provide insight or rules and regulation or some form of governance to the ownership of exotic animals. Now, exotic animals are also not defined in any legislation in Ontario, and so that could be anything from a tarantula to a moose to a tiger. And so in Ontario specifically, it's not a thing that I see a lot here in BC, but if you're from Ontario, you know this to be true, whereas like the second you leave Toronto, the second you drive maybe an hour, 2 hours outside of the city, you are bombarded with these roadside petting zoos, these roadside safaris, these like roadside enclosure situations where it's literally all these randos spread out throughout Ontario's suburbia who have gone out of their way to like illegally import tigers or lions or elephants or giraffes, what have you. They bought some fence and then they're like, yeah, okay, come visit my petting zoo. And the bigger gag about this is there have been not one, not two, not three, we're talking hundreds of escapes, like multiple times where wild animals that have no business being in Canada, let alone under the care of just random citizens, right? These animals, there are multiple times that they've escaped. And y'all, the gag is every single time this happens, who has to pay the price? It's not the humans, I'll tell you that much. It's always the escaped animal, always, always. Especially if that animal can cause a threat to humans specifically. And one of the ways I think that this kind of conflict of like escaping your enclosure can really manifest or maybe can result in kind of like a positive change, not in Ontario, but in Indiana, was because Indiana was very similar to Ontario in that they didn't used to have any kind of like wildlife ownership governance laws until the situation where this guy who had like a roadside show situation similar to the ones we have here in Ontario. Just like, it was actually a very sad story, so I'm not going to give you all the details because don't want to bring you down, but essentially released all of his cats into the urban landscape and then was like, bye, cruel world. And then the police had to go out and hunt and shoot all of these escaped exotic cats. And then this, like, Indiana was like, oh my gosh, okay, maybe we should have like some laws to prevent this from happening in the future. So I want to pose that to y'all. And the question I want to leave you this week is like, do you think that there should be more regulations in place when it comes to the animals that we have in enclosures, in either zoos, aquariums, rescue, rehabilitation facilities, what have you, right? For me personally, I think that there needs to be much, much, much more oversight. And there needs to be maybe some restrictions in place so that the animals that are existing in enclosures are only the animals that would exist within that natural geographical range anyway, right? So if you have a zoo in Cincinnati, you're not going to have an elephant in that zoo because elephants aren't from Cincinnati. You get what I'm saying? Like if you have an aquarium off of the coast of BC, you're not going to have Atlantic salmon up in that because you're on the Pacific coast. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like things like that, where we can start to be a little bit more critical about how we're even housing these animals in the first place, so that if these escape situations do happen, it's not this huge detriment, right, to the animals and the people that we share the space with. And with that final note, I think I'm gonna leave. Thank you for listening. Again, sorry for the audio difficulties earlier on Monday. It is now Tuesday, but you're probably listening to this on Friday, unless you're a patron, which in case you can listen to this whatever, but in the future, they will always be out on Monday for you. Yes. Okay. As always, you can get the episodes, show notes, some of the extra content and the articles and other different little bits of information that we mentioned in this episode will be available over on the Patreon. So that's patreon.com/jauntingj. If you are not a Patreon baddie, no problem. Head on over to the Instagram. That is instagram.com/jaunting.j. And that's essentially it. That's where you can find me, on Instagram or on Patreon if you want to support, get some more targeted information. Otherwise, just join me daily, weekly for some general animal fun. Okay, gotta go. Bye, y'all. Oh, last thing. I have finally heard back from Kamau, and I think episode 12... you'll be hearing the official theme song, but don't want to, I'm not going to hold myself to that, because if it's not episode 12, then it's not episode 12, and the theme song comes when it comes. But I did hear that it is being worked on now that the computer is fixed. Thank you, Kamau. Bye, everyone. Catch you next week. Ciao.